You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 24th of November 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
Ahead on today's programme, we'll get a guided tour of the new release bookshelves with literary agent Claire Conville.
We'll also explore the intersection of music and technology with Joanna Seguro, who's the owner and director of Lumen.
As a cinema near you anticipates the release of Mike Newell's film of Great Expectations, we'll commemorate the bicentenary of Dickens' birth, as well as assessing this latest interpretation.
You are Pip. I'm here to inform you he has come into a handsome fortune, and he has great expectations.
And we'll be guiding you through the weekend's cultural occurrences around the world in general, and in Seoul in particular.
So, as ever, lots to look forward to ahead this week on The Review on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. It is Saturday at a bit after midday, and that means it's time for The Review, in this instance with me, Andrew Muller, and Emma Nelson.
And I suppose we must start very briefly in our capacity as reviewers of all things cultural to assess the departure of Larry Hagman from Dallas.
It is sad.
It is very sad.
81, but 81 fairly fulfilled years, I think it's fair to say, both off-screen and on. Because when you consider his on-screen career, first he played an astronaut married to a genie and then a billionaire cowboy.
Which is all he needed to do
exactly.
For the rest of his life.
What more do you want?
And there is this, there's this sort of slight sense of disbelief that he has in fact died, given the fact that in his fictional life, he has died and has been resurrected once quite famously, but then Dallas has just been brought back to our screens as well. And so one had this immortal sense about Larry Hagman that you could literally kill him and then bring him back to life again.
He did have one of the most famous fictional deaths in all of history, didn't he?
Yes.
It was extraordinary.
It lasted years.
It did. One of those cultural sort of happenings that I can remember growing up in Australia, where, granted, we are a bit strapped for, you know, breaking news, but programming was actually interrupted when the identity of his assassin was revealed. I remember there being a little crawler along the bottom of whatever television program I was watching at the time, which would have been a choice of about the three things that were broadcast in Australia in the 80s. And yes, it was sort of announced who had shot J.R.
I remember the tapes being brought to the United Kingdom, being hand-carried off a plane and being given an escort to the television studios out of which they were going to be played in order to ensure that the secrecy of JR's killer, who was...
Can you actually remember who it was?
I think it was Lucy. It was the little blonde one, that's about as much as I remember. Anyway,
who actually did it.
Rest in peace, Larry Hagman. Thank you for decades of slightly dubious but utterly enjoyable trashy telly. We start today with books, however, in a slightly more highbrow effect to get some recommendations from those inside the industry. I'm delighted to say that our literary agent, Claire Conville, joins us in the studio again.
Claire was an editor at Random House before co-founding her own company, Conville & Walsh, in 2000. Conville & Walsh now represent dozens of authors, including the satirist Charlie Brooker, historian Misha Glenny, the humorist Marcus Berkman, and the songwriter Luke Haynes, whose new album, The North Sea Scrolls, I recommend heartily. Claire, welcome.
Hi, lovely to see you both.
Thank you for coming back. You've brought a pile of books with you. What's the first one on the top there? It's obscured by the computer screen from where I'm sitting.
Well, actually, the first one I want to talk about is India Knight, a wonderful new novel, which is called Mutton. India has a fantastic following, through her Sunday Times column and as a sort of Twitter fiend, although I gather that's not a concept that... this radio station understands, but nevertheless. But anyway, it's a very, very funny book. It's about family life. It's about growing a little bit older. I laughed out loud on every page, and I literally recognised myself in almost every character and in every situation.
That's something that India Knight specialises, though, is sort of striking to the heart of the reader. What's the plot of Mutton?
The plot really is, there are lots of stories going on. There's, you know, her best friend coming to stay, who's just had a facelift and pretending to be 15 years younger than she really is. There's an ongoing story about having broken up with the love of her life and are they going to get back together. But it's really, in its own way, a very, very, very funny meditation on modern life and all the challenges that you might face once you hit your 40s. But it's done with great humour, with great love, with great compassion, and there are some fantastic set pieces. And it was just, I literally read it, I think, in one sitting, and I loved every second of it.
I always find it very hard to be convinced by these observations of city life in your 40s, because I often get the impression that many novelists happen to find themselves in that position. And it becomes a little bit autobiographical and doesn't necessarily always succeed. But Indian Knight always seems to pull it off. How do you think she does this?
She's a very, very, very good writer. And I think we mistake sometimes they're easy to read and they're accessible and they're fun. But actually what I know about working with a lot of writers over many years is that simplicity it requires a lot of hard work. There's a lot of thinking, there's a lot of thought. A sentence that seems straightforward may have she may have spent sort of a week writing it. So it's well thought through, if you like. She knows who her audience is and she likes her audience, and I think that's really important.
There is still a snobbery attached to things which are easy to read, as if that's a criticism of a book. Is it essentially a light, cuddly, fluffy thing, or does it have depths beneath the light, cuddly, fluffy stuff?
I don't think we're not kind of dealing with a sort of, you know, the bubonic plague or people starving to death in faraway countries. You know, I think we've got to accept it's about kind of urban life in contemporary England. But I think, yes, age, responsibility, being true to yourself. I mean, these are themes that are important, if not actually maybe sort of life defining. And I think she writes about them very well.
And the fact is she's been now translated into 28 languages as a result of this.
Yeah, she's hugely successful and has a huge, readership through newspapers and through other social media. And I think this is her fourth novel over perhaps the last, I'm trying to think, 12 years.
As an agent, when as we have just discussed, the concept of literature light, how do you ensure that it is taken as seriously as Indian Knight's work is now done?
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert at this. I'm an agent rather than a publisher. But I think my own view on any books that I read is, are they well written? I worry less about the genre or who they're aimed at. But two, I think if you work inside the industry, a key aspect of what we all try and do, whether it's a writer, agent, publisher, is identify who the readership might be and work towards ensuring that you find them, connect with them, reach them, so on and so forth. You know, that is part of our responsibilities.
Well, the next book I wanted to ask about, because it was one that made me curious in that it deals with a subject which, on the one hand, I find entirely risible, but I like the way that he's gone about it. This is Roger Clark's Natural History of Ghosts, subtitled 500 Years of Hunting for Proof, of which, of course, there is precisely none in that half-millennia search. But this is a hugely entertaining tour of the byways of history, because it's not just about the search for ghosts, it's about the people who search for ghosts and why they search for ghosts.
Exactly. I think he makes a very good point, which he says is you don't have to believe in ghosts, but something clearly manifests to people, whether it's images of people, whether it's knockings or voices or things that go bump in the night. So really what Roger is asking is how and why. And I found it absolutely riveting. I mean, I actually have seen a ghost. I saw a ghost when I was 13. But it was really interesting to me reading these pages, because I suddenly understood why I might have seen a ghost. And he totally doesn't make any kind of judgment. He just reports. He must have done an enormous amount of research, because some of the stories he tells, you know, from sort of the 17th century, 18th century, extraordinarily detailed. There's a host of fascinating characters. And there was one woman whose name escapes me, but who suffered from terrible migraines. She was married to the Earl of somebody or other. This was in the 18th century. She suffered from terrible migraines. Absolutely convinced that in sort of paranormal phenomena, died very suddenly, and her physician pickled her in alcohol and put her in a glass coffin so that when her husband came back, he could have one last look at her. I mean, I found that, you know, truth is stranger than fiction, and I found that absolutely extraordinary. And so the book is not just a history of ghosts, but, as I say, peopled with all sorts of fascinating characters.
I loved the excerpts that I've read of it, because you dip into it, and it's not one of those books that you necessarily need to begin read from beginning to end. It's a lovely winter book, because you get transported in a very vivid way into the immediacy of the situation, because many of these ghost stories are dating back to the 18th and 17th century, way back longer than that. But you find yourself plummeted into, I think there's a great Poltergeist of Cock Lane story.
Yes, that's brilliant.
Which is fantastic, because it has this gruesome portrait of Smithfield Market, which of course we'll talk about later. We're talking about the Dickens' Great Expectations, and that features in Smithfield Market, features in there. And you get these great images of, you know, the proper ghostly apparitions and the footsteps in the, down the corridor and the doors slamming and people being literally scared to death. And it is absolutely a great, great book to read.
I think, yes, particularly at Christmas, when, I mean, we all love a Christmas story on Christmas Eve. And I think, A Christmas Carol being written for that purpose. So I think you know, it's a really good all-round Christmas present.
It's gleeful and it's properly ghoulish. So if you're slightly timid of reading about ghosts and if you don't want to be scared too much, it doesn't really matter, actually, because the characters are so full that I found myself laughing out loud more than I did sympathising with the characters, which is, I don't know whether that's right or not, but the stories are just so juicy.
But they're all great stories about, as so many great stories are, they're about quests. And, you know, it's an ambition of his. He writes as well to see a ghost, having grown up in two allegedly haunted houses. And I'm sure most of the people who set off on quests to find ghosts are like people who set off on quests to see rare animals or even things like the Loch Ness Monster. I think they're pretty sure that it's not actually going to happen.
Do we think that Roger Clark believes in them?
Ah, well, that's the multi-million-dollar question. I think it's rather like, I think he perhaps would like to believe in them. But, I mean, as I say, he's very clever. He reserves judgment. He reports faithfully. He brings us a host of amazing stories, some of which are the basis for actual fiction. He reports one sort of haunting, which turns out to be the basis for The Turn of the Screw by Henry James.
Which is a great story, yeah.
But, I mean, I don't know, I've never met him, but I understand that this is a lifelong kind of passion, as you say, quest. He's been researching and writing for many years, and the culmination is this book.
It perhaps is the key to its success, that because we don't know that whether he believes or not, when we generally look at quests for ghosts, it is normally quite interesting characters who find themselves drawn to ghosts. One need only look on the internet, one need only watch television programmes, where characters who want to find out ghosts are usually very unusual in themselves. Roger Clark's narrative, as you say, takes one step back, and as a result, it lets you it lets you enjoy the book.
Yeah,
book as itself.
There was a wonderful character in here who not only sort of discovered, in inverted commas, ectoplasm, but also invented the helicopter. You know, you're thinking, well, it's a very strange double act, isn't it? You know, but it reminds me that actually we've, in a way, in the 21st century, sort of ghost hunting has been separated from sort of science and history, and is seen perhaps as
quackery.
The preserve, as quackery. Whereas in the 18th and 19th century, it was absolutely part of the wider social quest for scientific experimentation analysis.
He doesn't spare the quacks and hoaxes, though.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. And I think what he also does cleverly is you begin to understand how ghosts and poltergeists manifest in different ways over the century, and what kind of, if you like, social concerns or cultural issues they're reflecting. I found that very interesting. For instance, he was talking about whether ghosts arrive in black or white. And it turns out that is, if you're in hell, you're dressed in black. If you're on your way to heaven, your clothes, you know, you move away from black and your clothes suddenly go white. So that sort of interested me. You could judge your ghost by, or the malevolence of your ghost by, what they're wearing.
That was Roger Clark's book, A Natural History of Ghosts. It's available now. Want to move on to another, Narcopolis, that's already hit the headlines. A very, very famous book, straight into the canon, everybody's saying, because of its portrait of life in Mumbai through the eyes of a drug addict.
Yes, I mean, this was, I think, one of the surprises of the Booker shortlist earlier this year, and it's now gone on to be shortlisted for the Costa. I thought this was an absolutely brilliant book, high modernist, if you like, told in a variety of sort of not interchangeable, but connected voices, creating a fantastic view of modern India. You know, we really are post-colonial now. You know, all those sort of concerns about sort of Western culture and English influence in a sense have dissipated. And the connecting strand of this book is opium, is heroin, and the people who are taking it and how their lives connect and unfold. But I found it incredibly rich, incredibly mesmerising, would give it to any serious reader from the age of 16 upwards, and filled with extraordinary stories and actually told in this really beautiful, if you like, calm prose. And I can't recommend it more highly, really.
It has quite a spectacular beginning, not in terms of what is happening in the narrative, but in the structure of the first few pages. And this, the great top line, I think if you could possibly just dig it out for us, it mentions the idea of Mumbai, where the novel is set, surgically altering its face. Mm. And the first six pages are one sentence, painting a portrait of a group of people taking drugs. And the way that it is described has this... it has a comparison with a religious experience, that the sort of the pipes, the lamps, the ritual of the drug taking. And one has this idea that this, you know, the exaltation of drugs, which is clearly the premise for everything to go terribly wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think drug taking, as I understand it, addiction is about ritual more than anything, I think, for a lot of people. It's about the ritual of whether it's a joint, whether it's a glass of wine, whether it's a cigarette. It's about context. I think that I have to assume that Tahil knows all about taking heroin. And I think, in fact, the prose and the style of the book reflects that sort of distance one can get if you're taking an opium-based drug. I found it unjudgmental, which I thought was great. I thought it portrayed a very particular kind of life with extraordinary insight and detail and calm. It's not a life I lead, or most of the readers of this book will lead. But nevertheless, I found it fascinating.
In terms of the depiction of the setting of the city, how hard is it for any writer who's setting a story in Mumbai or Bombay to write their way out of Salman Rushdie's shadow?
Well, I thought this was interesting because I thought you could see Rushdie's influence here, particularly actually in the opening, I was thinking of Midnight's Children and the opening sort of sentences
of
Midnight's Children.
Which won the Booker Prize in 1981, didn't
it? Yeah. But I felt that, again, I was saying this is a post-colonial novel. It's a sort of, he's freed himself from the shackles of the West. You know, India isn't just an emerging nation, it is an emerged nation with all its successes and failures. I thought that's what this book reflected. I thought it was exciting and interesting, and it made me long to go back to India, which I haven't done for many years.
There is a new cultural reference point, though, with Mumbai, which is the chaos of Mumbai, as shown in Danny Boyle's film, Slumdog yeah. Millionaire. Do you think that as a result of Slumdog Millionaire achieving such huge success right across the world, that a novel like Narcopolis will suddenly find itself getting more attention than perhaps it would have done 5 or 6 years ago? Justifiably so.
I think we just have to judge it on its own merits. I mean, I think that since Salman Rushdie sort of broke on the scene, there's been enormous interest and focus on literature from sort of Asia and the Far East. It's just a question of who's a really good writer. Will this find a mass market audience? I don't know, but I just would recommend it to anyone with any interest in modern fiction.
Claire Conville, thank you very much again for joining us. This is The Review on Monocle 24. Next, we'll be hearing about art in Madrid, film in Tokyo, and music from Scandinavia. Do stay tuned.
This Christmas, Monocle invite you to Midori House for our first Christmas fair. Mixing up the best of Swedish Yule, Japanese Christmaser, and traditional English Yuletide, we'll be serving up festive cheer at the most elegant Christkindlmarkt in the heart of W1. We'll have live music with a Swedish choir, food by Granger & Co, and our hand-picked retailers can help you with your Christmas shopping. Plus, you can meet a real, live reindeer. So, head to number 1 Dorset Street on the 1st and 2nd of December from 11am to 5pm to meet our Finnish Santa and all his little helpers at the Monocle Christmas Fair.
Welcome back to The Review. Now, as every week at around this time, it's time to hear from Monocle's associate editor, Nelly Gocheva, who's been scouring the cultural listings from all over the world to bring you the best that the coming days have to offer in different cities. Take it away, Nelly.
This weekend in Madrid, Galleria Arnes y Roepke presents Tiempo de Absentia, or Time of Absence, a retrospective of Slovenian painter Cveto Mrsić. Mrsić's deft brushstrokes and playful color schemes reflect a complex relationship with his surroundings. This is Mrsić's fourth solo exhibition at the gallery, and it runs until the end of January. The London Castle Project Space welcomes Heidi Locher's exhibition, Hotel California. An architect by trade, Locher marks a shift in focus towards the art world. Her interdisciplinary show examines hotels as unfamiliar spaces, using photography, installations, and a short video. Hotel California is on until the 27th of November. Opening this weekend in Tokyo is Filmex Film Festival. Coming a month after Tokyo's International Film Festival, it focuses on independent cinema from Asia and the Middle East. We recommend Kim Hee-jung's highly anticipated Grape Candy and Kim Ki-duk's Pietà, which won the Golden Lion at this year's Venice Film Festival. For a complete schedule and program, visit filmflex.net. Montreal's gallery, Trois Points, presents Puzzle by local artist Mathieu Lévesque. His experimental approach to art is clearly seen in the way he brings painting closer to sculpture and architecture. The unusual yet appealing results can be seen at the gallery until the 15th of December. And on our playlist this weekend is Swedish dream pop singer El Perro del Mar. Fresh from recording a vibrant set at Monocle 24 Studios, she brings her new album, Pale Fire, to cities across Europe next week. Be sure to pick up the album this weekend to enjoy some danceable electronic pop. And then, enjoy the real thing as El Perro del Mar visits Paris, Barcelona, Madrid, Stockholm and Oslo. For more information, go to elperrodelmar.com. Let's hear Pale Fire. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
And that was the Swedish singer El Perro del Mar with Pale Fire. She's currently on tour across Europe, and you'll be able to hear her Midori House session on Robert Bowne's Culture Show in just a couple of weeks' time.
And from music to more music, because it's time now for our weekly music review. And today we're continuing on the sound art theme we picked up on last week, although this time with a slightly more tuneful collection.
I'm delighted to say that in the studio we're joined by the curator, Joanna Segura, who's owner and director of Lumen, a production company which runs projects linking arts and technology from tiny club nights to huge international festivals. Welcome, Joanna.
Thank you.
We gave a bit of an introduction as to what Lumen do, but could you expand, please?
I find it very difficult to explain to people why I do, particularly my parents. I
get a lot of that.
Yeah. I like to do a variety of different things. And my idea is that a lot of the work that I do is project-based, and I always like to do different things. So I always go for, if I'm doing a club night, I'll try to do something different than I've never done before. If I'm working with a brand to develop a project for them, it has to be something that is unique, and it hasn't happened.
So
it
means, is all sound-based?
It started off sound-based, but I have to say that the other day I was speaking to a friend, and this year I was working with the Serpentine on the Yoko Ono exhibition, and that was part of her participation smile project, and that was just photographs. What has happened is, throughout my career, I started very much coming from the music industry, and that was my passion. But more and more, I've developed an ability to get my head around very difficult and weird, wonderful technological projects. And so more and more, I'm branching out and doing more things that are not so sound-based. But I think music is what I love, so somehow it always ends up being there.
So give us a concrete example then, or a specific example of a thing you've worked on recently or are working on now.
Well, I just got back from Italy, so I'm working on this project called Seven Notes. It's a partnership with Bowers & Wilkins, who do speakers and headphones. I'm sure most people know the Zeppelin, which is a wonderful iPhone dock, and working with Maserati, the car company. And we developed Seven Notes, which is the project, which is musically led by Howie B., fantastic producer, and he has been recording the Maserati engine and creating music around that.
Now, how did this come about? What a terrible job this must be. I'm so sorry for you. How does a project like that come about? I mean, do you just get a phone call from Maserati saying, come on board, we want to do something creative?
Because I do a lot of projects that are sound-based, I have a very good relationship with Bowers & Wilkins, who are fantastic at providing speakers for really experimental projects. And so they gave me a call and they said, Howie B's working on this idea of making tracks from the engine and we want to tour it. How would we go about it? What would be the event? And this is what we're trying to explore now to do next year.
What did you come up with?
Well, we're going to be working on the grand tour, and so we're going to be traveling and creating seven events in key cultural cities that are going to be exploring the musical culture of each city, and bringing Howie as our in sort of conductor. And I have to say that the musical idea of creating a composition around the sound of the engine really comes from Howie, because he is the musical creative behind this project. So I'm just adding on a project with, like, how can I take that concept a bit further and make it a worldwide event?
We can listen, I think, to some of Howie B's music from this project. This is All We Are. Was Howie B with All We Are, the first of today's music selections by our guest music reviewer Joanna Seguro, the owner and director of Lumen. I didn't hear a lot of Maserati in there.
Oh, I did.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, in the background.
I was kind of hoping for a sort of, I guess, a kind of crescendo of revving cars, a sort of Ride of the Valkyries arranged for the V12.
Oh, it's just ticking over, Andrew.
But then I don't have terribly subtle tastes.
I mean, we really focused. The recording process of the engine was a very careful one, because we wanted to make sure that we were not recording the tyres, all the other noises that come from a car, the exhaustion, and just really focus on the purring of the engine, which I know for car enthusiasts is just fantastic. Fantastic.
Oh, it's amazing. Mm. I was a very happy girl listening to that. What I found astonishing, though, is that I didn't know how you'd gone about recording it. Mm. Did you have it when the car was moving, or was it in the workshop, and then you have to control the acoustics there?
We
You've got so many things to play with.
Absolutely. Howie worked with the sound engineer, particularly looking at ways of not creating. So the car was suspended. It had the axis floating to make sure that the tyres and all the other noise weren't interfering with the recording, and so that we got exactly the sound of the engine to be able to do it. So yeah, a very evolved process.
May I ask you, how strong a piece of music do you think it is if you didn't know that there was a Maserati in the back of it?
I think just being able to hear the idea behind the project, obviously it's very hard to understand it. I love it. It's a collaboration between Howie and a band from Liverpool, All We Are. And I just think for someone to be able to put that element into a track and to sound that beautiful. Because I always find that sometimes when I think about cars, you have a very male-driven kind of sort of like strong acceleration, you know, sort of like beats going. And I think that track is something that I would listen to happily at home, and I absolutely love it.
And when is it? When are you taking this all on tour next year?
It's going to start in March, and we're going to be touring until July. So,
well, sticking seamlessly with the theme of music and technology, then I want to move along to your next selection. This is Felix's Machines, which is a man called Felix who builds machines, and it sounds a bit like this.
And that was Machines 140207 by Felix's Machines, a musical choice of our music reviewer today, Joanna Seguro. Joanna, explain the context of that, because it's a delightful little twinkly bit of sound when you hear it without knowing what's going on in front of your eyes. What are we seeing as well?
Well, this is a composition by Felix, and I have worked with Felix throughout the years, and he pulls apart pianos and he pulls apart drum kits and any instrument or shower racks that he gets his hand on, and then he modifies them using solenoids. So everything that you're hearing, this is actually a mechanical sound. And what he does, and he takes electronic music, which has always been a passion, and he creates an instrument which he builds himself, and it's all acoustic.
What do you think's more important here? Is it the ends or the means? Do you think the music works in and of itself, or do you need to see these fabulous Heath Robinson variety contraptions which create it?
I guess it's a similar question about the concept with the Maserati engine or not. I think the music stands on its own, but I'm interested in the idea behind the creative process. Seeing Felix's Machines live, being in front of them, and it is because every sound you hear has an LED light that triggers. So it is a beautiful sound and light show, and it makes electronic music, which all of this is composed electronics, so tangible that it's a unique experience. But I think the music is strong. I think compositionally wise, what he's doing using acoustic sounds, it's something that no instrument could do. There's almost the limitations of an instrument, and he has created his own instrument to break away from it. So I think musically and from a composition perspective, it's just fantastic.
Your third selection today is called, well, I don't know how you pronounce it. It's no with three O's. So I think we're kind of looking at like an anguished exclaimed yelp of no. Like, no.
No.
I think is what it probably is pronounced.
This is by is that about misery, Joanna? How do you say it?
Well, I should have asked the others before I did.
In my head, it's no. This is Seeming. Could you introduce Seeming for us before we introduce the song?
Absolutely. Seeming is a fantastic classically trained but jazz vocalist, and she is truly experimental. She has a fantastic range in terms of the keyboards that she uses, and she's a one woman collaboration hub and also composer. All her compositions are incredibly cinematic, and she does everything herself. And I think to find a woman that has an outstanding voice but can also do all the electronics and the music production behind it is truly unique.
So let's have a listen to N with three zeros. No, by Seeming. And that was no, we think, we believe, by seeming they're the choice of today's music reviewer, Joanna Siguru from Lumen. What I quite enjoyed about that was that when, again, I think you have to be given a bit of context before you can listen to these pieces of music. And then once you know what's going on, it becomes 10 times more exciting, was the fact that this was all looped.
Yeah.
Because when I first heard it, I thought it was a collective, slightly treated, but with a very improvised quality to it. And yet you've just told me when we were listening to that, that is all very tightly controlled and computerized.
Absolutely. It's all her. And that is, she's just released her first album, which I helped release. And even live, she can do everything herself. And she can do the looping and singing and the keyboard playing and the piano playing and the celeste playing and the electronics. And I think it's just wonderful experience. And I think this track is probably one of my favorites because it just gives a little taste of the things that she can do.
There's a element to it as well, which is when you discuss sound and art, you sometimes find yourself questioning where you would listen to something like that. When I heard "No," I thought, actually, I don't think I'd find that too unpleasant in my own home. Mm. It's not almost music, but it is artistic music that suddenly makes the whole genre very accessible.
Mm. I like to think so. I think some people still struggle to listen to something that can't just be in the background, that every once in a while it grabs their attention and it calls out to bring them. It's like, you have to listen to this. And I think there's tracks in her album that definitely have a feel for it. But I just think I'm interested in the sound art, which is not that challenging. It's very much about being able to listen to and just being lured into, and in that way start experimenting a bit more outside the norm.
And moving on, Joanna, I must ask you this question. When you're not doing this, what do you actually listen to at home?
A variety. My boyfriend is really into kind of sort of a very eclectic mix, and I actually like to give him control of the stereo so I don't have to make the choices that I have to do in terms of work. I think that happens a lot when you work with music. So for example, tonight we're going to go to Awesome Tapes for Africa, which is this DJ, which is a website, and he literally finds awesome tapes from Africa and is just fantastic. And so things like that, little gems that you can find online, is something that I'm always researching. And I like to go back to old records that really signify something for me, and sometimes put it on. So last weekend we had a Tom Waits weekend of just playing some of his old records. It was just fantastic.
You can't go too far wrong with Tom Waits's older records, especially everything up to Heart Attack and Vine.
I don't know if I could do an entire weekend.
Sucker for the big soppy ballads with the string arrangements. Joanna Siguru, director of Lumen, thank you very much for joining us today on The Review. We're going to play you out with your final selection. This is Stubborn Heart with Starting Block. That was Stubborn Heart with Starting Block, the final selection from today's guest music reviewer, Joanna Siguru of Lumen.
It's Saturday, so you must be listening to The Review. Time now to explore some cultural happenings in a specific city around the world. Today we head to Seoul, where Monocle correspondent Jason Strother is our guide.
If you want to get out of the cold and into a nice toasty cinema this weekend, check out Korea's top box office seller, A Werewolf Boy. It's directed by Jo Sung-hee and stars Song Joon-ki and Park Bo-young. The Yongsan CGV multiplex shows A Werewolf Boy with English subtitles. For photography enthusiasts, the third annual Seoul Photo Festival runs until the end of November. It features shots from both professional and amateur photographers that cover Seoul's transformation from war-torn to ultra-modern. The exhibition is spread across 23 different venues, including the Seoul Museum of Art.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight.
If you're looking for some music, Sir Elton John will be touching down in Seoul for one night only. His 40th anniversary of the Rocketman tour comes to Olympic Park on November 27th. You can try to get your hands on some tickets by reserving online at ticket.interpark.com.
Rocketman, burning out his fuse out.
The secrets of sparkling are revealed at the Dalen Museum Swarovski exhibition. Check out the crystals of various celebrities and learn the backstory of how this jeweler became a fashion mainstay during its 117-year-long history. Crystal artwork will also be on display at this gallery in Seoul's Angukdong neighborhood. And 'tis the season here in Korea, and what are the holidays without a European-style Christmas market? Some of Seoul's expats will kick off the annual event on Friday, November 30th in the Songbuk Fountain Square. Holiday decorations and food will be on offer, as well as hot glasses of Glühwein that are sure to keep you warm. For Monocle in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
And you're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We will be back after this to talk Dickens.
The power of photography was pulled into focus at this year's Pre-Pic Day, the world's leading prize for photography in the realm of sustainability.
These are true artists, and they have incredible integrity. I mean, they tell you how it is. In the process, it's often disturbing. Sometimes it's beautiful in an abstract way, but it really touches a nerve.
Monocle Films attended the awards, and you can watch our film in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. Great Expectations is perhaps Charles Dickens' most accessible novel. These two presenters certainly remember as schoolchildren ploughing through the trials and tribulations of the hapless Pip, the heartless Estella. Actually, that would have been brilliant if when she'd said, "I have no heart," he'd replied, "I have no hap."
Do carry on.
Why didn't Dickens think of that? Anyway, and the Eternal Bride, Miss Havisham.
Perhaps as a result of it being so widely read in schools, it is a work that's seen enough on-screen interpretations to keep the world's inflammable wedding dress businesses in hearty financial shape. The latest version brings Hollywood to the marshes of Kent and to London. We're delighted to welcome back the critic Jasper Rees from theartsdesk.com, who's here to give us his take on it and reflect on the somewhat overlooked Dickens bicentenary. Welcome once again, Jasper, to The Review. And you have brought a copy of the book itself in.
I have my dog-eared old Penguin edition.
And may I, now I'm looking at that edition, and that was the edition that I read as a child.
Yep.
Is this a copy of a book that many people around the English-speaking world will have on their shelves and will remember from being children and having been forced to read it and then always determined to go back to reread it but never quite bringing themselves to do so?
I don't know if people were forced to read it necessarily. I mean, my memory is of reading it, and I can only speak for myself, reading it voluntarily. And it is a book that is great for children, I say not young children, but children who are emerging, you know, into their teens to read, because the first third of it is about childhood. And there isn't a better description of childhood in the whole of English literature than in Great Expectations.
And before we move on to the latest screen interpretation of it, what are your thoughts rereading it?
Oh, it's so good. It's even better than I remember it.
Is it worth revisiting as an adult then? Because, again, like a lot of people, my first encounter was as a schoolboy, and I remember my English class in about fifth or sixth form in Australia taking quite a gin pip. In fact, our creative writing question in our end of year exam, because our teachers had a sense of humour, was to take your least favourite character from any of this year's texts and dispose of them in whichever manner you see fit.
What a great creative writing teacher.
It was, but poor old Pip. God, the things we did to him.
Oh, poor old Pip. He's quite a complex character, isn't he? Because he's in answer to your question, Annie, yes, it is worth going back to read all Dickens, in my view, but particularly Great Expectations. It's the story of someone who is, in Dickens's phrase, raised up. He has this this extraordinary thing happen to him that he comes into some money and he doesn't know the source of the money, and being the son of or being a blacksmith's boy, apprentice to a blacksmith, he suddenly is taken to London and turned into a gentleman. And it's actually a compellingly relevant book. I'm not really big on talking about relevance, but when you consider that social mobility has more or less ground to a halt in the last 15 or 20 years, it's sort of like I would say the Dickensian equivalent of someone going on a reality TV show and suddenly becoming wealthy and well-known.
Now, this latest version, I mean, there have been dozens, I think, of interpretations of Great Expectations. Yep. This greatest, latest version, Mike Newell, of Four Weddings and a Funeral fame.
And Harry Potter
and 4. Harry Potter 4.
Yeah.
What's been his take on it?
His take, in tandem with David Nichols, who wrote One Day, is to do something between a comedy and a romance. So the comic elements of the book do those flavours come out, and you can tell from the casting. Robbie Coltrane playing the in the book he always seems terrifying, but he's sort of comically terrifying in this version as Mr. Jaggers, the guardian and lawyer who takes charge of Pip when he comes up to London. And we've got Helena Bonham Carter as Miss Havisham. Which is
a role one would imagine the woman was born to play.
Exactly, but she does seem to be playing it as the Queen of Hearts. I think she's forgotten that she's not in Alice in Wonderland anymore. I mean, in a way, it's clever casting to go for someone who is in their 40s. Because Miss Havisham, when she is, for the benefit of your listeners who don't remember who she is, she's this woman who lives in a crusty old house where everything has been allowed, where time has stood still since the moment she was jilted at the altar only 20 years before. So she should only be in her 40s. And often you see her played by wizened old crones.
It's always crones for telly.
But she does really do it for comedy. And I suppose, in a way, given that it's been done other ways, there's nothing wrong with trying a different tack.
Doesn't quite work for me. Does the film capture the subtlety of caricature that Dickens is always very good at? Because when one reads Dickens and when one sees the interpretations of Dickens right across all his work, you know that he's having digs at various areas of society, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't when it's an interpretation.
I'm not quite sure that it does. For example, in this version, the convict who Pip helps at the start of the book appears out of the mist, and that is actually a very key moment in any Great Expectations adaptation. Is when Magwitch appears, you are meant to jump out of your skin, because just as Pip would have done in the graveyard, seeing this terrifying figure emerge from the primordial soup, and of Kent, yes, and it's not scary enough. This, and in fact, I thought that Ralph Fiennes was kind of channeling Ron Moody in the film version of Oliver, and I kept on expecting him to break into "I've been reviewing the situation" or "you've got to pick a pocket or two."
That's such a shame, because before we came on air, the first thing that I thought about when we came with screen interpretations was the David Lean version, which I saw when I was tiny. And ditto. I remember being a little girl. I remember nothing of the film apart from the scene where Magwitch jumps out and grabs Pip, shakes him upside down and says, "You say anything and I'll slit your throat." And I remember being 8 years old and being terrified by it, almost to the point where I rewatched it this morning with a little trepidation, really concerned that I again was going to be too terrified to watch
it. And what happened? Well, you obviously got into work.
I'm still alive. I'm okay.
she worked through it.
It was very good cinema. Yes. That's all I can say. It's fantastic.
They do the child's eye. I mean, the great thing about Great Expectations is he writes from a child's eye view, even though he's remembering events that happened much earlier in the character's life. And you do see him from upside down in that particular scene, but it's not scary enough. The thing that does work, I think, a bit, although I'm not wild about the performance of Jeremy Irvine, who plays the older Pip. Interestingly, his younger brother Toby played the younger Pip. The romance, that a very, very strange romance in which Dickens puts so much of his weird anxieties about the female sex. The romance with Estella, who she's played by Holiday Grainger, and actually she does capture something of the coldness and the remoteness of the figure from the book.
The reviews of the film have, I think it's fair to say, been equivocal. We do have a clip of it, though, which we can hear now, I think.
"It's nothing but a stupid labouring boy."
"What do you think of her?"
"I think she's very pretty. Very proud. You can break his heart."
"You are fit. I'm here to inform you he has come into a handsome fortune." and he has great expectations.
A clip there of the new interpretation of the Dickens novel Great Expectations. Jasper, this has been a year when it has been Dickens' bicentenary, and yet it seems to have passed us by at a time when Dickens and London surely were a perfect marriage.
It's passed us by, I think, mainly for the, you know, the elephant in the room, London 2012. The London 2012 festival has absorbed a huge amount of the oxygen of you know, people's attention this year, and a part of it was the affiliated event, the World Shakespeare Festival. So I think everyone's eyes were elsewhere. But there has been a hell of a lot of Dickens around. It's the BBC last Christmas put on their own version of Great Expectations, and they did their own... they finished Edwin Drood. And they had a wonderful, only this month, version of Nicholas Nickleby, which they cleverly updated. They called it Nick Nickleby, and they set it in the present day. And it really made that huge kind of babbling melodrama of a novel come alive again. They showed it across the week from Monday through to Friday every afternoon. I'm not quite sure who it was aimed at because it wasn't on in half term, oddly. But it sort of tapped into the idea that if Dickens were alive now, as everyone says, he would be writing Soap. And I don't know if you remember, either of you, that Andrew Davis, the great adapter of TV, did A Bleak House
which
a few years
brilliant.
Ago, which was wonderful. And that was done in half-hour episodes twice a week. And this did the same sort of thing. The updating thing again really worked because, you know, as we live in times of considerable financial hardship, and that novel is partly about the greediness of bankers, it really, really did work. It was very impressive.
I do remember reading a few years ago somebody trying to prepare for the 200th anniversary of Dickens' birth by opening Dickens World in Chatham, a theme park of some sort. Have you been?
Pass. No, I haven't. Have you?
No. It does sound terrifically ghastly. That's why I was actually kind of interested in talking to somebody who had.
Maybe anyone that's short of buying Andrew Muller Christmas presents this year should consider Dickens World tickets. Jasper Rees, thank you as ever for joining us here on Monocle 24.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of this instalment of the Saturday Review. It's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Katie Bilboa, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and the studio manager was Toby Hammond.
And if you'd like to hear a little more Monocle 24 cultural content, every Monday at 1900 hours London time, you can enjoy a new episode of Culture with Robert Bound. Here's what's coming up next week.
On the latest Musictastic edition, we chill with a Midori House session from Jay Brannan, get all blue-eyed soulful with Nick Waterhouse, and gaze admiringly at our favourite Bowie and Beatles album covers at a new album art exhibition in Copenhagen.
But from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.